Our next case on the calendar is A23-0483, Dalton v. TMS Treatment Center, doing business as Carlson Drake House. Counsel for appellants, as you are getting ready, counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant. When you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party that you are representing. Please feel free to be seated as well. The podium in the middle has a button underneath, so you can adjust up and down the podium. You can also adjust the microphone so we can hear you as clearly as possible. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jay Ryan, and I represent the appellant, Dennis Dalton. The issue I'd like to focus on this morning is whether the failure to serve an affidavit of review in a malpractice case deprives the district court of jurisdiction, but later invokes the statute of limitations when an affidavit is served. In this particular case, the issue was whether or not this claim involved medical malpractice such that an expert would need to be testify to prove the prima facie case of malpractice. And the court ruled, in essence, that it did, and because the initial complaint and summons were not served with an affidavit of review pursuant to 145.682, the court did not have jurisdiction to hear the case. But then the court later found it dismissed the case with prejudice, which is, in effect, a finding of merits, dismissal on the merits. I think those two things sort of straddle the issue. Under Rule 3, an action is commenced with the service of the summons and complaint. There is nothing in Rule 3 that requires anything else to be served in order to commence an action. The statute of limitations, section 503.02, similarly does not require a service of anything such as an affidavit of review in order to confer jurisdiction. The only place that is discussed is under section 145.682, which is the certificate of, or the affidavit of review statute. Now, the court sort of had to thread the needle on this a little bit, because if you look at what section 145.682 subdivision 6 talks about, which is a safe harbor provision, it says that if a medical malpractice case is served without an affidavit of review and one is required, that the court has to give 60 days after receiving notice of this deficiency in order to provide the plaintiff the opportunity to file and serve a certificate of review. If that doesn't happen, then the court dismisses the case with prejudice. In other words, not pursuant to Rule 41.02C, which is an involuntary dismissal, but rather it dismisses it with prejudice. And I think that's where really the confusion results. So,
well, and the facts here are that you did file an affidavit.
An affidavit was filed, and I appreciate it, Your Honor. So initially when we got this case, we were retained in mid-June of 2022 after a couple of previous lawyers had had this case, and they asked us to take it over. I was out of town the last part of June and started looking at this case in early to mid-July, and that was because of my vacation schedule. And initially, I think that the plan was to bring in a licensed professional who owned this building. His name was Terry Schneider. And a decision was made not to make him a defendant. And so the certificate of review that was filed as I recall, it was contemplated for Mr. Schneider's involvement, which never actually took place. Now, the certificate of review, affidavit of review, was filed with the court, but it was not served with the summons and complaint. And so you had a...
Was it filed within that 60-day after demand?
So it ultimately was. And I'm trying to sort of parse out the difference between the filing and the service. When this case was filed with the court, an affidavit of review, excuse me, was filed with the court but was not served on the defendant. After the motion to dismiss was filed and pursuant to the Brown-Wilbert case, we treated that motion to dismiss as a 60-day demand for an affidavit of review, which was filed within, served within the 60 days and also filed with the court. So
the bottom line is you complied with the safe harbor.
We complied with the safe harbor.
How is this different? And I can appreciate that. How is this different from the cases where, if you don't have a trustee appointed, because it's a wrongful death, and you don't do that, you're supposed to, and in the interim, the statute of limitations runs, and we've tossed those. How is this different from that?
Your Honor, because I appreciate the question, I believe that was the Ortiz v. Govenda case, and that was a jurisdictional threshold.
So your argument is this safe harbor is not jurisdictional?
Correct.
And as long as you comply with it.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Well, it's not jurisdictional. Another panel of this court in O'Fallon made that exact holding, and that was back in, I think, 1987, and it has been, if I looked on Westlaw yesterday, it's been cited by numerous courts ever since then. And so the idea in O'Fallon was that the issue of whether or not that was the section 145.682 is a jurisdictional statute was decided by the Court of Appeals, and they said it's not. It's a procedural statute. And I think that's really the kind of comes down to the bottom line here is that the district court in this particular case sort of said both things. You'll notice that the court said,
I think the district court had never dealt with this.
Right.
So at the end of the day, you got to pick a side, and the district court chose that side. I wouldn't fault the district court for making a decision when it specifically said in its opinion, no one's kind of ever talked about this. So, but again, tell us why O'Fallon, in your mind, governs here.
Because O'Fallon is a case where the Court of Appeals decided specifically that in referring to a California statute that's similar to Minnesota's, saying that this is a procedural type of statute. This is not something that either confers or deprives the court of jurisdiction over hearing the medical malpractice matter, but rather governs the procedure in which the medical malpractice matter is determined. And I think that kind of dovetails with Rule 41.02 sub C, which says in effect that if a case is dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, that is not a dismissal with prejudice, that is a dismissal without prejudice. But in this particular case, the district court dismissed this case with prejudice. In other words, on the merits, and so it was saying that it didn't have jurisdiction, yet it exercised jurisdiction in order to dismiss the matter with prejudice, which I think is inconsistent with one another. And I think that the district court's error was in that determining that this was a jurisdictional threshold, that 145.682
is... Or was the district court simply understanding that statute of limitations has run?
Well, the district court specifically held that there was insufficient process, and that was the jurisdictional issue. In other words, it held that in order to bring a medical malpractice case, you must serve an affidavit of review along with the complaint and the summons. And by not doing that, the court had no jurisdiction because the case had not been commenced under the rules and under the statutes. And the fault that I find with that logic is that section 145.682, the subdivision 6, which is the safe harbor provision, specifically says that dismissals under that statute are with prejudice. In other words, they are on the merits. And so in order to dismiss a case on the merits, the court had to have jurisdiction, but it said it didn't have jurisdiction because the case was never commenced because there was no affidavit served with the complaint and the summons. And so it's sort of this circular argument, and I think the court, the defendant, actually tried to, sort of figure a way out of that when it said, and the court adopted this, defendant moves not under Minnesota statute section 145.682, but rather the relevant statute of limitations which ran before plaintiff cured process. And so, the court adopted defendant's argument, which was no, this is not dismissal under 145.682, because if it was, then the safe harbor provision would have prevented that. And there's that, there's Judah v. Obsack case, there's the Brown-Wilbert case. There's all these cases that say, no, the safe harbor provision doesn't let the court dismiss the medical malpractice case until the 60 days has elapsed and plaintiff has failed to cure by serving an affidavit of review. So in order to avoid that particular issue, defendant said, okay, well, this is, we're moving under the statute of limitations, and the district court adopted that, but then said it's a dismissal with prejudice, which can't be a dismissal, on the merits.
But if the district court dismisses with prejudice, basically the district court was saying, I don't have any jurisdiction. I have no subject matter jurisdiction because the statute of limitations has run. Therefore, there's nothing more for me to do, and refiling is not going to cure it. It's over and done with.
Well, that is the conclusion that it drew, but I think it had to have based its decision on 145.682 and not the statute of limitations, because if it just considered only the statute of limitations, there's nothing in there that says that this case has to be served with an affidavit review. In order for the court...
Under Rule 3?
Under Rule 3 as well. And so taking those two rules, the only way the court could reach the conclusion that it could dismiss this case with prejudice is to invoke 145.682. But when it does that, it has the safe harbor provision that says it has to give 60 days. And it also has to dismiss it with prejudice, which is necessarily not a dismissal without prejudice or dismissal for lack of jurisdiction, which is what it also found in the same order.
Counsel, I wanted to switch to your other argument, which is, we don't really need an expert affidavit to begin with. Looking at the statute, it defines healthcare provider, and then it defines healthcare. And it defines healthcare as referring to professional services rendered by a professional or an employee of a professional and services furnished by a hospital, sanitarium, nursing home, or other institution for the hospitalization or care of human beings. How is this facility not an other institution for the hospitalization or care of human beings?
Thank you, Your Honor. And
I mean, this is not a group home, right?
It's not a group home.
And he is getting therapy of some kind, and there's a therapy plan, right? And in your complaint, you're saying, hey, the plan was bad. So it seems to me if you're talking about a plan being bad, we need an expert to say, what should the plan have been? So how do you – and I understand your argument that, any idiot would not have let him out. Because of his history, but I guess the difficulty I'm having as to why an expert affidavit is required is that this is an institution for the hospitalization or care of human beings, and that they did provide therapy. So now, why don't you tell me why I'm wrong?
Thank you, Your Honor. I hesitate to tell you that you're wrong. I would just say
no one else hesitates. So join the club.
Well, Your Honor, Tosignant, and I may be butchering that name, but Tosignant v. St. Louis County, which is the, I think, the seminal case on this issue, was sort of the same set of parallel facts, which is that there was a lady in a nursing home, and the nursing home clearly is a medical provider and clearly is in a 24-hour nursing care, much more so than this IRTS, Carlson Drake was. And there was an order in place for her to wear a safety vest so that she wouldn't fall and hurt herself, and the order was not followed, and she fell, and she hurt herself. And the Minnesota Supreme Court, after several rounds of appeals, Minnesota Supreme Court held, look, if someone doesn't follow a doctor's order, that doesn't require an expert to tell the jury you should follow the doctor's order because it's obvious that you should. In this particular case, our complaint is not that the plan was bad or that they didn't say they were going to do something that they're supposed to do. They had a plan for what's called a wander guard, which is essentially a safety bracelet. If someone leaves the building, it goes off. They had security cameras, and they had a plan for if someone was AWOL, in other words, absent without leave, they're supposed to report them and get them back. And the reason they had to follow these things was because Brady was a vulnerable adult. He had meningitis when he was 14, which caused him to have a bad brain injury, which caused him to have schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and an addiction problem. And as a result of that, he was not trustworthy. He was not safe on his own, not due to his own fault or due to his own shortcomings, but because of a disease process that he had when he was 14. And so the state committed him, and he needed to be in Carlson Drake or someplace similar so that he wouldn't go out and buy drugs and ingest them. And what happened here was he was supposed to be on a wander guard, he was supposed to be monitored, and he was supposed to be searched when he came back into his room.
But that seems to be a negligent supervision. And I think, you know, in CC versus Fairview Health Services, you know, negligent supervision seems to require an expert witness. And so, I mean, I understand your argument. I understand the argument, but I'm just, look, they even said, and I understand, you know, the case you cited, that yes, you know, if, you know, you don't need an expert to say follow orders. But, you know, in another case, I'm trying to find it. It's the one where they said, yeah, a decision, an employee, you know, in Henderson v. Alina Healthcare Systems, a hospital employee's decision not to raise a patient's bed rails required a medical judgment. Now, you know, it seems to me follow the order on how to care for the elderly woman is not so different from, you know, either you raise the bed rails or you lower the bed rails. But we said, we said, you need that. And this seems to me even more than the bed rails. This is, okay, here's his therapy plan. Here's what we know about him. Here's what he needs to be supervised. And this is what happened. And I think you do need an expert for that. So I'll, if Judge Reyes will allow you. Perhaps you can
Thank
answer
you, Your Honor.
Questions, please.
I guess my response to that, Your Honor, would be I don't think you can't medically decide as an unlicensed person who Adam Meyer was. He was the night person. You can't decide not to follow, to use a wander guard. You can't decide I'm not going to watch him on the security cameras, and you can't decide I'm not going to check his bed every hour, which was the other order that he had, because he had previously overdosed on Benadryl during the first week of his stay at Carlson Drake. So I don't think that.
But don't you need testimony to say, and this is why? This is why you needed to watch him. This is why we needed to do this. You know, he's not getting better. He's getting worse. And he's had a history of that. It seems to me I'm not so sure that is within the realm of a jury, a layperson's knowledge.
And that's why the safe harbor provision, because if I'm wrong and the district court doesn't agree with me, then I get 60 days to cure that.
Oh, I believe me, this is different from the 60 days.
Sure.
I understand the difference.
I guess what I'm saying is that I looked at this, and it was pretty obvious to me that There's an order for the water that, you know, the inspector general, the health department found the same thing, which is, you know, they were supposed to have watched the water guard. They're supposed to monitor them every hour, do bed checks, and they didn't do any of this. And I don't know that that is in my mind, is a fair interpretation of a medical judgment exercised by somebody who doesn't have the right to do that. Thank you, Your Honor. I would ask that this court reverse and remand the district court's decision.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please state your name for the record, party you're representing. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chris Goodman, representing the respondent, TMS Treatment Center, doing business in Carlson Drake House. This case was dismissed for insufficiency of process. The process that the plaintiff needed to serve was defined by the wrongful death statute because this is a wrongful death action. But the wrongful death action arises out of medical malpractice. Therefore, to determine
what allows him to cure an affidavit in 60 days. I just think, and I think it is tricky, but I think the statute of limitations is start the lawsuit. The expert affidavit is you got to have an affidavit, and if you blow it, you get 60 days to fix it. I do think they're trying to get at two different issues. So why, and I think the district court conflated them because, you know, the statute of limitations did run if you believe the safe harbor doesn't apply. But even in your briefs, you keep, even if your briefs, I notice, you know, you always refer to failed to cure the defective process before the 3-year limitations period expired. And I think he did cure it. He just cured it within the 60 days, and those 60 days, granted, were after the 3 years. But I, and I'm speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I think he gets to do it. I think there's nothing in the statute that says he can't do that. So why am I wrong?
Yeah, a couple things, Your Honor. First of all, just there was a question earlier about kind of the timeline here. The action was filed, I believe it was August 16. The summons and complaint were served the day before the 3-year wrongful death statute ran. In between, an affidavit under 145.6.682 subdivision 3.2, which says I need more time, that was filed but not served. That affidavit was never served and has never been served. Okay, so we move to dismiss, and then we get within 60 days.
Wasn't that served on October 27th of 2022?
That's the affidavit of expert review.
Right.
Right. What I'm saying is when the action was filed about a week before it was served, the appellant filed an affidavit saying, I need more time. I've got a copy of it here. But that wasn't an affidavit of expert review. There's a footnote in the lower court decision being, I believe the word was skeptical, the court said, that that would even comply with the statute. But that affidavit that was filed has never been served. So the first affidavit that's served comes later.
I'm sorry, I'm still a little confused. Are you saying that the expert affidavit has never been served?
I'm saying the affidavit of expert review was served on October 27th. That sounds like the correct date. I checked that this morning. Okay. What I'm saying is the affidavit the counsel was alluding to during his opening comments here was not an affidavit of expert review. It was under subdivision 3, parenthetically 2, where you say, I need more time to submit an affidavit of expert review because of the statute of limitations.
But that's a different issue. That starts the 90-day. We're
right.
Talking about the 60-day.
Right.
That one was never filed. I didn't think that was in dispute. That one you can do right away and say, hey, I wasn't able to file an expert affidavit before the statute of limitations has run. FYI, I will be filing it, and then you get 90 days from that one. But
right.
The 60-day one that we're talking about is the one after a demand for an expert.
It is, and that was served on October 27th. What I'm saying is there was an earlier attempt to comply with the statute, but that one has never been served.
Does that even matter, though?
Well, because it gets to the legal issue that I think this appeal raises, which is if the summons and complaints in a wrongful death action are timely served, but because the wrongful death action arises out of medical malpractice, an affidavit of expert review is not served with a summons and complaint. do we have this 60-day provision that allows the service of the affidavit of expert review within 60 days of a demand to relate back as if it was served when the summons and complaint were served?
Why does that have to be served with the summons and complaint? When I look at the plain language of 573.02 subdivision 1, it only talks about an action shall be commenced within 3 years of the date of death. It says nothing about filing or serving an expert affidavit.
And that's why we distinguish, it's in a footnote, page 35 of our brief, but that's why we distinguish the Parker v. O'Phalen case, because that wasn't a wrongful death action. And the rules are different. The case law in the state is clear. The rules are different for a wrongful death action, because the wrongful death action recognized by the legislature is contrary to the common law. Therefore, the legislative act of recognizing that cause of action creates not only the right but the remedy. And so that's why in a number of cases, when parties have attempted to commence suit, but they haven't complied with the statute, the action's dismissed. Now the question is,
But where in, I'm still not following you, because I don't see anywhere in the statute of limitations, which is what the district court relied on, 572.02, where does it say that commencement of the suit in a medical malpractice, which is what this covers for wrongful death actions, correct? Which would be medical malpractice. Where does it require that the expert affidavit be filed and served at the commencement of the suit?
We wouldn't be here if the statute answered the question, and perhaps if there was case law answering this legal issue.
Well, but that's my point. It's not in there, it's not part of the requirement. We have to go by the plain language, and if it doesn't include it, and that's included, other things are included in terms of what needs to be part of the commencement of the suit, but that's notably absent. It doesn't say it anywhere in there.
Right. I was going to make that point and get to the next point, which is that's why we cite the Podvin case versus Walker Jamar. In that case, the action was dismissed for insufficiency of process, and the statutes, it says in the case, that the analysis of what was sufficient process turns on, I believe it was, statutes 5.25 and another statute in 302A, chapter 302A that applied to dissolved corporations. And what the court was saying there is, because this is an action, I think they were asbestos plaintiffs, against a dissolved corporation, the answer of what's the proper, the necessary process that needed to be served isn't just a function of the statutory, whatever right of action they're trying to assert. It also dovetails with the statutes that are applicable to commencing an action against a dissolved corporation.
Yeah.
So Your Honor.
I think you raise a good point, is we have to read the statutes in conjunction with one another. It seems to me that your reading of the statute of limitations would basically read out and make irrelevant Minnesota Statute 145.682, which does provide a safe harbor saying if an expert affidavit was not filed and served with the original summons and a demand for that is made, then the party has 60 days to file the expert affidavit. It doesn't say anything, however, if this is beyond the statute of limitations period, you're toast.
The two statutes do not contemplate the circumstance we have here, which is the kind of cases that tend to find themselves into the appellate courts. But the holding that the district court reached that I'm advocating for today is that because a wrongful death action is a completely different animal in terms of creating the right and the remedy, and it's strictly enforced, there are cases that we cite where the concept of relation back doesn't apply. I'm thinking of one of the cases we cite where it was actually a medical malpractice claim. The plaintiff wasn't able to serve the perfect service on its own, so the plaintiff solicited the help of the sheriff. And the delivery of the pleadings to the sheriff was timely, but the plaintiff was not diligent in ensuring that the pleadings were then served by the sheriff within, I believe, 60 days thereafter. So we looked at something beyond just the wrongful, that the medical malpractice statute to define what was the proper process. The point being, there was a very strict enforcement of that wrongful death statute, because although there was a delivery of the pleadings to the sheriff before the limitations period expired, the plaintiff failed to ensure that the pleadings were actually served in the right period of time.
That's the requirement of the rule.
That's a requirement of the rule, yes. But the point we're making here, the point of that case in Podvin is of that case and the other ones we cite, Ortiz versus Grenada, is you have to have strict compliance with a wrongful death statute. And that was my opening remarks were, what's the process in this case? The district court said because it's a wrongful death action arising out of medical malpractice, the process would be the appointment of a trustee, the service of the pleadings, but then also this affidavit.
We also have the Paulos case that basically talks about that if the expert affidavit is not furnished with the complaint, then a demand constitutes actual notification to the plaintiff the statutory requirement to file that expert affidavit. Then the law allows another 60 days to comply.
The statute, that case, Your Honor, tracks the statute. The point we make in the brief, and I'll say it here again, is that case, the Parker v. O'Phalen case, those are not cases where the action is a wrongful death action, and that statutory requirement to properly commence a medical malpractice case, or legal malpractice case, I suppose, isn't served before the limitations period for the wrongful death action expired. And that's a decision the district court reached. The process for this wrongful death action includes the service of that affidavit of expert review.
Would you agree Minnesota Statute 573.02 is plain and unambiguous?
I think the statute read in isolation is not ambiguous. The problem, of course, here, in terms of statutory interpretation, the canons that Your Honor is alluding to, the problem here, of course, is we have the interplay of the two statutes. And as it was a matter of first impression, the district court concluded, and I believe, of course, rightly so, that...
But we give no deference to the district court's determination on review of statutes. We do that, undertake that de novo.
That was an interesting... Yes, Your Honor, every one of the judges on this panel has issued decisions that I've read applying the statute, and I've noticed that when dismissal is under 145.682, the case law says that's an abuse of discretion, but then if it's statutory interpretation, it's de novo. So...
Right. What you have is
I'm a little confused by that, but
right. Well, what you have is we reviewed the district court's overall, overarching determination for abuse of discretion. District court abuses its discretion if it makes findings that are clearly erroneous or misinterprets the law, and
right.
That it's under that prong of that we review de novo the statutory interpretation.
Yeah, and I think if we were to just having a scholarly discussion and we weren't limited in time and whatnot, the issue would be, what do we do with these two statutes? Are we bootstrapping one on the other? Well, no, this is a wrongful death action that arises out of medical malpractice, so the two statutes
are implicated.
Well, I'm
not sure if it was bootstrapping, because going back to when you referenced what the district court the district court decided, I think the district court basically ignored 145.682. And just focused on the statute of limitations.
The analysis of the district court was in citing, I think it was the Paulos case, because of course opposing counsel brought that up in the court below, was that case does not address the application of the requirements of commencing a medical malpractice action when the circumstance here is that the action was not, a wrongful death action, was not commenced before the limitations period expired. The judge said it's a matter of first impression, and then we have the issue. So what I'm saying is, if we're having a scholarly discussion, the question is, do you lose the 60-day safe harbor if you fail to file the affidavit before the limitations period expires? The district court said yes. The alternate holding that the appellant's advocating for is, I still get it. Well, now we have a loophole in a wrongful death statute that's consistently been strictly construed and applied, saying that you can serve the pleadings, and you have to serve those, before the 3-year limitation period expires for this type of claim. But you still get that additional time, which doesn't even begin to run until the defendant makes a demand. And I believe the district court correctly decided that issue. Again, and the one thing the district court cited, of course, is the same thing I keep repeating, which is that trying to find some guidance from the appellate decisions on how to apply these statutes, there's Broehm, B-R-O-E-H-M, that's the Minnesota Supreme Court case, and then a number of cases interpreting the wrongful death statute. They all keep saying strict compliance, strict compliance. And so I think the district court hewing to those precedents was a proper application of the way these two statutes interplay. Because the alternative is now we have an exception to that strict compliance. We're saying case after case, strictly comply with wrongful death, strictly comply with medical malpractice, but not so here.
Strict compliance, because it violates strict compliance, because all it says is an action shall be commenced within 3 years. It doesn't say that commencement of a wrongful, of a cause of action under the wrongful death shall include an expert affidavit. And it seems like it would be reading out, you know, 145.682 by not allowing that safe harbor, especially if when the initial complaint is filed, it seems like in this case and others, there may be a question. Is this truly a medical malpractice, a wrongful death, or is it something else? Is an expert affidavit actually required or not? And that's even in dispute here. So why shouldn't the district court and even the parties have the opportunity to look at it to see whether or not, is this really medical malpractice, and is an expert affidavit required? If it's not, then it doesn't really matter.
My time is up. I can hit just 2 points in answering the question, and then I'll sit down. Number one, on whether this is a medical malpractice case, the medical malpractice statute applies to licensed healthcare professionals. Terry Schneider was. He was originally named but not served as a defendant. Adam Mayer was an employee of his. The case law, I believe the Cy Reed case, I'm not pronouncing it correctly, but I believe Your Honor decided it. It's a medical malpractice action.
I'm sure I mispronounced it too.
Okay. Well, okay.
On that, I did want to ask Judge Reyes if I could ask one follow-up question.
Yes, please.
So, look, there's no doubt in my mind that this is a residential treatment center, and therefore it complies with that portion of the statute. But the other point of appellant's argument is, you know, whether or not the person was watching, now I'm going to forget the word, you know, the wonder camera.
Wander guard,
thank you.
Yes.
Whether you follow an order to deal with the old woman in, you know, whether she should be restrained or not, and, you know, either you follow the order or you don't. I mean, if there was a instruction to watch him on wonder guard and he didn't, why do you need an expert for that? I mean, so why... Explain to me why you need an expert following up on appellant's argument that, you know, anybody can see if he's supposed to watch the Wonder Guard and he's not watching the Wonder Guard, that's a problem. So why is appellant wrong rather than me?
The first of the two comments I wanted to make to Judge Reyes's question was who? Terry Schneider, licensed healthcare professional, Adam Mayer works for him. The people targeted in this case are fit within the class of persons the statute was designed to protect. Okay. Your Honor's question then gets to the next thing I was going to get to, which is the what. Why does it apply? Okay. Well, first of all, the complaint sounds in the language of a professional liability claim.
I give you that.
Standard of care, et cetera. Now, then when we get to the meat on the bone, well, what did they supposedly do wrong? They didn't develop a proper plan, how the patient should have been cared for. They should have changed the plan after there was the Benadryl use, the monitoring that occurred. And not just that what is described as a ministerial function of complying with the Wander Guard. So there's more to it than that. My time's up. The last thing I'll say to get to Your Honor's question, I did say I had 2 points. That's why I mentioned earlier the Podvin versus Walker Jamar case. The process that was necessary to properly commence that action involved, again, I think it was 5.25 in a statute in Chapter 302A. And so the court had that same problem. It wasn't a wrongful death case, but determining what was the proper process involved other statutes. In this case, the proper process that had to be served before the limitations period expired, because this arises out of medical malpractice, draws in that affidavit of expert review. But the district court found, and we're asking this court to affirm, to conclude and say that because of the strict compliance for the remedy and right that the legislature created for this type of case, wrongful death, you don't get the 60-day window to fix something that you failed to serve when you commence the action the day before the limitations period expired. So we'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I think the issue here is that the way the statute is drawn up is it gives the plaintiff the decision making to determine whether his case is going to need an expert or not. And
you know, I agree with that. But when I looked at your complaint, it just jumped out, standard of care, treatment plan, how was the plan implemented, what kind of plan. I mean, that's clearly falls within the
requirements of an expert affidavit. I mean, the jury does not know what plan this unfortunate young man should have had or not. And I think you're stuck with your complaint.
And I understand, and so the idea is that if I'm wrong on that, and if the court tells me I'm wrong, or if the other party tells me I'm wrong, I have the opportunity 60 days to fix that. And it's not a jurisdictional issue. And that's what the problem was here, is that the district court turned it into a jurisdictional issue when there's a 60-day thing. And the problem that the defendant and the district court have had throughout this is trying to either associate or disassociate the two statutes, 573.02 and 145.682. Because if you just read 573.02, it says nothing about an affidavit of review. You file and you serve your case, and within the statute of limitations.
Do you agree? You know, we are constantly being told that we don't issue enough presidential opinions. It seems to me, and since in this case the district court is saying, do you agree at this point in time we need to issue a presidential opinion dealing with this issue in terms of the statute of limitations and the 60-day cure period in order to discuss the interplay with them?
Your Honor, that's an interesting point, and I guess I'm going to answer it two ways.
Oh, you mean though. Only if we rule your way? You
Well, I mean, I could say that, but I'll say this. I think it's, you know, as the Chief Judge noted, it's the statute 573.02 is not ambiguous. I mean, it says what it says, which is that it doesn't say you need to serve an affidavit of review. So I think that on its face, it doesn't need interpretation because there's no ambiguity to it. And that's really kind of what the precedential question is, you know, should we interpret 573.02 and its interplay into 682? Well, you know, 682 has already been interpreted, you know, many, 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 many times. I mean, we have a whole list of cases in which they said, you know, there's a 60-day right to cure. And so that's been interpreted. I guess if the court wants to make doubly sure that these two things are separate, then that is a good reason for doing that, because the defendant is unclear on this. I guess maybe healthcare providers are unclear on this, but it's clear to me.
Oh, no, I think they're quite clear.
Okay.
There's no confusion in my mind about how they view the statute.
And I think that's what it comes down to in the very end. This statute is not designed to deprive vulnerable adults of access to courts, which is the way that it's being used here.
So your short answer is yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would ask the court, I appreciate your time, I'd ask the court to reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing. Helpful to us on this issue, which seems to be one of first impression. I'm sure your clients appreciate your representation of them as well. We'll be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both.